Welcome to Forests, Folklore, and Fantasy. My name is Kelly, but I write and publish under my initials as K.M. Rice. Wherever you happen to be while listening to this, I want to give you a heartfelt thank you for tuning in, and of course, let you know that you are so very welcome here. My guest today has traveled from across the seas. His name is Ronan O'Connor. He assisted me with my Afterworld series as a linguistics consultant, for he is a native Irish speaker. He also happens to be my partner, and as such, we share a lot of common interests, and in many ways, we're brought together by our mutual love of fantasy. So I invite you now to join me in a conversation with Ronan about our love of Tolkien, folklore, and a bit about what life is like in the Gaelic-speaking regions of Southwest Ireland. Ronan, thank you so much for joining me. I know you often feel a little put on the spot by the things I make you do or ask of you, like being on camera on Happy Hobbit and now asking you to be the final guest of this season of Forests, Folklore, and Fantasy. But please do say hello.
Hi, everybody. How are you? I feel it's a big shoes to fill. being on this.
You are a stranger, though, to being on air. I know you've been on the radio before. Do you want to share a teeny bit about that?
I would have spoken on the radio a few times here and there. Mostly in Irish with the local radio station at home, Radio na Gaeltacht. And most recently would have been, I'm a commercial fisherman by trade. And the boat that I was fishing on had to take decommissioning. And I was talking about that sometime last year. Mm-hmm. That was my last
public appearance.
I suppose.
Yeah. So would you mind telling us a little bit about the region of Ireland that you're from? And what makes it unique?
Well, I'm from West Kerry. I suppose it's kind of a rural part of Ireland. I come from about 7 miles west of a town called Dingle, or Undangan in Irish. And I grew up in a Gaeltacht region, which means that, I suppose, people will still speak Irish in a Gaeltacht area. So I suppose when I was growing up, I went to primary school. I suppose over here in America, you guys would call it elementary school. But in Ireland, it's national school or primary school before you go to high school or secondary school. And it would have been through Irish, you know.
So most of your education, or maybe all of your education, was in Irish?
Well, most of it. Like, obviously, you're not going to be doing English in Irish or French.
Oh, true. You know? Yeah.
But other subjects we would have learned through Irish. And they'd incentivize that, like, you get 10% of, you know, let's say you get 50% in the exam. Let's say you're doing maths, for example, and you choose to answer through Irish, you might have to use a couple of words of Irish, you know, like, instead of saying equals, you'd say cover 'em or whatever.
Okay.
it wouldn't be much Irish that you'd have to use in the maths. Obviously,
of course.
Mostly figures and stuff, but you get, let's say you get 50%, you'll actually get 55% if you've answered through Irish. They give you 10% of your mark on top of what you get. So
okay.
It's incentivized to do your exams through Irish.
I see.
Like, even if you're doing French, you can say, yeah, I'm answering through Irish, put your name down on the paper in Irish. Most of the rest of the answers are going to be in French. You know?
Yeah.
But you'll still get your 10%.
So you get incentivized for using Irish as your natal language, like as your baseline. Rather than England.
No, I suppose when you're doing the exam, you have the choice. There's two little boxes you can tick whether you're answering through English or Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take the answering through Irish box, you get 10% extra on your mark.
I believe it or not, I do meet people who have never heard the term Irish before as a language, because it's something just not super well known outside of the country. So when you're saying Irish, you're referring to, I'll just say Irish Gaelic, as opposed to, there's also a Gaelic dialect in Scotland that would be the Gaelic, right? Scots Gaelic.
Mm-hmm.
But since you're in Ireland and it's your native language, of course you're speaking Irish.
Yeah, I would have referred to it as Irish my entire life. Gaelic, in Irish. You know,
mm-hmm.
people call it Gaeilge. They call it lots of things. My dad would have had very good Irish, way better Irish than what I have. And he
grew up, that was his first language, correct?
More or less, yeah. Irish would have been his first language growing up. Yeah, he probably, like, his dad was a school teacher, so he probably was privileged more than the other, his neighbours and stuff would have had less probably interaction with English than what he would have had. But, you know, like, having his dad being an educated guy, mm-hmm. he would have had English. And my dad's mother was a nurse, so she would have had English as well, like, you know. But like that, they would have all spoken Irish. Probably 95% of the time, you know.
So when you, growing up at home, did you use both languages or was one predominant?
I would use both languages because my mother was born in England and she wouldn't have had great Irish. No, she would have been able to understand the language. But you see, she was, I think she was about 12 by the time she moved to Ireland. And I don't think she ever kind of spoke the language, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have spoken English to my mum. Now, I would have been exposed to Irish when I was around my grandparents on both sides, because my mother's mother would have spoken Irish as well. Mm-hmm. And my dad's parents, they both spoke Irish on top of all the other relations you'd have as well, like, you know. But I suppose I would have spoken both, but even from when I was a young child going to school, it would have been reinforced because you'd be speaking Irish in school all the time. I remember we kind of get punished if we were caught speaking English. You wouldn't be allowed out to play lunchtime. You'd have to stay inside in the classroom, like, you know.
How confident do you think it is nowadays? Because I know the language has been in a steep decline for various reasons. I remember learning that up until the 90s, I think all tests nationally were conducted in Irish to encourage people to learn the language. But then they got rid of that because an argument was made that you're not testing people's knowledge, you're testing their proficiency in test taking in Irish. Mm-hmm. But now, correct my pronunciation. You grew up in a Gaeltacht.
Gaeltacht.
And I know those are essentially linguistic pockets.
Yeah.
In Ireland. And I'm not sure how many there are, but my impression is that it's uncommon, that the average person from Ireland might not be very proficient in Irish.
You would be correct on that. You know, like it all depends. It depends on the parents, whether they speak Irish, the location, you know, like I think most of the schools would be through English, you know. But there is Gael schools that you'd have, you know, Irish speaking. So obviously in Gaeltacht areas you're gonna have Gael schools. And I know that a lot of parents would send their children to school in a Gael school rather than a school that wouldn't teach through Irish, you know, through a want that the children would have Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And like I remember growing up as a kid, a lot of the children from other parts of the country where they wouldn't speak Irish, you know, they could be from Dublin, they could be from anywhere, but they wouldn't be from a Gaeltacht area usually. Now you won't get, sometimes you'd get somebody from another Gaeltacht that would be, they'd come down trying to get better at the local dialect, like, because Irish, you'd have so many different dialects around the country. Like if you go to Cork, there's Gaeltachts in Cork and they'd have their own dialect. You go to Galway, it's different. Up around Caharu Rua there and Galway and places, there's a Gaeltacht there, and they have their own kind of unique dialects that they'd be different. So sometimes, most of the time, it would be a person from a part of the country that they don't speak Irish, and they're trying to, they could be attending a Gael school where they're learning Irish and they're trying to get better at their pronunciation and using the Irish and all that. So they'd come to our area in the summertime and kind of do like an extra, you know, like there'd be some classes, and you'd have a Ceilidh then every night, a Ceilidh, it's like a big dance, you know.
So these would be school-aged kids coming,
students,
coming from out of the area as sort of a linguistic summer school program. In America, we call it summer school, but and then they get to party every night.
There'd be a small Ceilidh where they learn Irish dancing, you know. And the local kids, we used to all, during the summertime, we're not in school. And the thing to do would be to go down to the Ceilidh Hall and meet all the
fresh blood.
Meet the fresh blood. They used to call us na buachalí átula, which means the local boys. So you'd have the canara, or the kind of leader, canara, I suppose, would be whoever would be in charge of the people teaching them.
Okay.
And they might be complaining about that, oh, in the Bochany Atula, you know, the local boys, they were doing this or they were doing that, or, you know, we might be knocking on the windows of, because when they come, they'd all stay in local homes with a lady, or it could be a guy, but it's usually a woman that would have extra rooms in her home. And they have to obviously be able to speak Irish, but they call them Banan Tí, or the woman of the house, you know. You'd have Faran Tí as well, would be the man of the house. And they stay in those houses. But I remember we used to, you know, when we were kids, you might be friends with somebody in such and such a house, and maybe after the Ceilidh, you'd walk them home, and they'd have to be inside from a certain time.
Okay.
So
it was a form of having some parental supervision over what I'm guessing is teenagers.
They'd be all ages.
Okay.
From, I suppose, national school age up, like, you know, they'd be all ages. You'd get older students that were in college. You know, there's so many different courses.
Is there an option for adults? For example, someone like me abroad who would like to learn more Irish just off the top of your head? Are you aware if there's...
I'm sure there is plenty.
Because what fascinates me by this description is it sounds like it's not just a language program. It sounds like it's a cultural immersion program because they're learning the language of their ancestors that... I shouldn't even say that because it's still alive and well. But they're also learning some of the traditional dance.
Yeah, I think the main aim of it is to improve your Irish, like, you know. But I'm sure that they cover a lot of other educational things. You know, you can learn about nature through Irish and. By doing so, henceforth, improve your Irish at the same time.
Right.
Stuff, you know? But, you would have the Céilí Dearnach then was the big night at the end of the course where they'd be all going home after and everybody'd be crying and there'd be plenty of broken hearts.
Oh, no.
And God knows that, I suppose, many's the young man back in the Gaeltacht that would have never have had... a girlfriend if it wasn't for the Céilís and the Gaelins, as we used to call them, or the Lobjaws. Lobjaw means fine day. So the old people used to call them the Lobjaws because they'd come around when the weather would be fine.
In the summertime.
It's a Lobjaw, the Tacht. You know, you'd see the students coming, right? Like they do the courses. At the beginning of the summer would be the younger kids.
Okay.
And as the summer goes on, then they'd be getting older, the courses. And towards the end of the summer, you'd get the college students coming then from places like Mary Immaculate College in Limerick. You'd get the students that would be training to be national school teachers themselves. And you know, they'd have to have good Irish. So.
And just for context... To unpack a little bit about why this was such a thrilling and exciting moment, what's the population like of let's just say Dingle? You're not from Dingle, but that's the closest big city.
Well, I wouldn't consider Dingle a city. No, it's more like a town.
Okay,
but I think, you know, I'll have to fact check myself on this, but. I think the population of Dingle is only about 2,000. But I believe that population, it goes up to about 10,000 in the tourist season, like, which I think Dingle has about 9 or 10 month tourist season, you know?
Oh, wow.
Dingle is very much a tourist town.
You're correct. I just looked it up.
Yeah.
The 2016, I'm guessing, census had...
puts it just over 2,000.
Yeah, 2,050. And that's the nearby big town, so that should give you some more context as to why it is so exciting for locals when they do get this influx in their population. The locations of the Gaeltacht in Ireland fascinate me, especially the region that you're from. And I can't help but think of the colonization that Ireland underwent at the hands of the British Empire. For what, roughly 800 years Ireland was occupied?
Something like that, yeah.
And how the locus of power was Dublin. Which, if you're unfamiliar with the geography of Ireland, Dublin is on the far eastern side of the island. So, of course, closest to the British Isles. And one tends to notice that the further west you get, so in other words, the further you get from the locus of power, the more indigenous Irish customs and language have survived. Renan has another explanation for that as well. And that's because in the 1500s, under British rule, the penal laws were enacted, which were essentially an attempt to force the Irish population to assimilate and to shed any semblance of their cultural identity. They were prohibited from openly practicing Catholicism.
That's right, yeah.
And from speaking the Irish language.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me your theory about why then it still exists to this day, in particular where it does.
Well, I suppose that in the any built up areas or anywhere where the British authorities were present, you weren't going to be speaking Irish, you know. And I suppose that the only places that it could have survived really were the out of the way places, rural areas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think there is Gaeltacht areas in Dublin now, but I don't think there would have been historically, you know. Like, I think that the language just survived in the places where it did, you know.
Almost, I don't want to say underground, but more or less trying to fly under the radar, trying to escape the attention of the folks in power at the time who really were committing a form of cultural genocide. And don't get me wrong, many genocides have actually been committed against the Irish people. But what I'm more interested in is, from an outsider's point of view, it seems that the survival of this language under such oppression allows a person to have a link to their ancestors and their cultural customs and practices that has not been severed by the colonizing force of rupturing that link via language to the knowledge of their ancestors. To you, we've had this conversation before, it's fairly normal to be able to look at a dwelling and know that your family members from 300 years ago lived in that area. For me, as a United States citizen born and raised here in California, that's a completely foreign concept.
Yeah.
I think I speak for many of us in the diaspora and many of us who are living on land that wasn't the land of our ancestors per se, going back multiple generations. That's a connection to source and to location that we're subconsciously searching for. And you have it.
Yeah, I suppose I would. Like, my family would go way back generations in the area that I was brought up, like, you know, on both sides. My father's father was the last of a long line of blacksmiths. And they lived in the same place for hundreds of years, you know. That was my dad's side of the family. And my mother's side then. My mother's mother, she came from I suppose only a couple of miles up the road from where I live. And her family went back generations there as well, like, you know. So I suppose it makes you feel kind of grounded that you're part of where you live, you know.
That connection to the actual physical landscape.
Yeah.
It's it must be empowering in some way to know that you walk the same boreens your great-grandfathers walked.
I suppose it is, you know.
It's also entirely possible that as an American, I'm romanticizing this a bit.
Well, like, I suppose it would give you some kind of you have a kind of a confidence of where you came from, you know? I suppose it's probably just normal for me, you know?
And in your area, people have fished for as long as we can document. You're a fisherman.
Yeah.
From my point of view, you're participating in this unbroken chain of continuing the culture of your specific region.
Right.
To you, it's probably just, well, this is an industry that we have now. And it's, you know, something I'm interested in. I know you love the sea and being out at sea.
Yeah.
Then I'm wondering if, you know, your father fished as well, if you feel a connection to the sea even. You know, I was talking about the landscape, but the sea and the land, if that's something that you've ever paused to think of, and maybe you haven't until I've just randomly put you on the spot in front of a microphone.
Growing up where I did, I was always close to the sea. I had the privilege for the best part of 25 years of living in a house that was literally a stone's throw away from the ocean, you know? And it is something that I find difficult to describe, but just you can hear the swell of the water hitting the land and stuff like that, even during the daytime there. Sometimes they could be, if there's bad weather, you can easily hear the waves and stuff like that crashing and whatever. But even on a still day, you can still hear the, I suppose, the swell,
mm-hmm.
to where the water is moving in the harbour and stuff like that. And it's,
you have an ability to read the sea.
When you move away from, if you go to a place where you're not near the sea, I would notice it,
mm-hmm.
that it's not there, like, you know.
Like right now, you're in California, and now I'm 6 miles inland. We can hike up a hill and look at the sea, but that's completely different. I remember when we first met, I said, oh, I live near the ocean. And you said, oh, so do I. And then I later found out, no, he means he can look out his window and literally see the Atlantic.
Yeah.
The vast expanse of the Atlantic looking westward. And I live, again, 6 miles from the actual coast, which is still close, but we had two different concepts, and some of that's inherent in our cultural differences as Americans. Our country is massive. Ireland can fit inside of my state over 5 times.
Right, yeah.
So we just have different perceptions of distance sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to compliment your ability as an Irishman to read the sky. There have been several times that you've read the clouds and been like, there's going to be a shower of rain. And I'm like, no, it's not in the forecast. It's fine. And well, then you get proven to be true.
I won't claim that that's anything to do with me being Irish, you know.
I think it does come from living on a place where it's so rainy.
Yeah, it does. It rains a lot. But I suppose that if rain is the worst thing that's going to happen, like, you know.
Yeah.
Like over here, I had the pleasure of experiencing a little one of your what would you call them?
An earthquake.
Yeah, I wanted to come up with a quirky term.
I know. It was just a little shaker. It was under a 5.
Yeah, and I like, thought that somebody was trying to move my chair or messing with me or something. And I was like, who's doing that? And next thing I was looking up at the house and I could see the house moving. And I was like, wait a minute, nobody can do that. Like, you know?
My favorite is that you were on the phone at the time to a buddy back home, and in true Irish fashion, he was telling a story and you're like, listen, I just went through an earthquake. And he's like, all right. And then just kept going with his story.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, I remember that now.
So speaking of stories, one thing I really enjoyed talking with your dad about, and one thing I really miss being able to talk with him about, is his wealth of knowledge of local history and folklore.
Yeah.
I felt like he could look at any part of the landscape or islands, to include the sea, around where you were, and he could tell you, if not the documented history, the oral history.
Yeah.
Of the place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you feel like that was just your dad as a person, or do you feel like there's a connection between having that unbroken link to your ancestors through not losing your language and preserving some of that cultural memory in terms of those stories?
Well, I suppose it has to help a lot if you have the same family living in the same place for a long period of time, you know, that you're going to have the same stories, you know, the local history is going to be repeated, isn't it, you know, within a family, like, you know.
And what was the way that these stories were preserved? Can you speak a little bit about the history of, like, Ashanachwi?
Well, I suppose Ashanachwi is a storyteller, you know. Like, back in the days before you had TV and stuff, you know, or even radio, the way people used to entertain themselves in Ireland would be that they'd go what they call a bahantiacht, and bahantiacht means a bahan is a shed in Irish, and like it wouldn't be sometimes somebody might have it in a shed, but usually it was from house to house they'd go, and you know, everybody would congregate in such and such a person's house tonight, or the next night it could be somebody else's house, and you'd have people that were kind of good at telling stories, and if there was somebody good at telling stories, they kind of had a title of you know, Shanachy, it means kind of storyteller, and they would have told stories that they would have learned from other storytellers, or from, you know, if you travel around a bit, you might hear different stories, and you'd pick out the good ones maybe and bring them with you to the next place. And you know, there even was people that actually moved around from place to place, and they would bring the better stories with them and stuff, so the stories would have traveled around and stuff like that. So a lot of the history probably would have been passed down orally like that, like, you know.
I remember learning, I believe it was early medieval Ireland, that bards were in a class of their own, and that a bard did not have to have fealty to any kingdom, and that a bard could cross the territories unmolested because they were one of the most admired, revered, sought after members of society, because you wanted them to come visit your court or your community to share these stories from even just news of other places, but also share a new story.
Yeah, I'm sure that they were very important.
I feel like you have some storytelling genes in you. What were the competitions that you've won in the past?
Well, I suppose it probably started for me when I was doing like plays with my school as a child, you know. I started doing a bit of acting, and I was good, I suppose I was good at the plays and stuff, and that led on then to the teachers and stuff became interested in me in that I might perform, you know, in two person kind of, I don't know what to call them. In Irish, you call them agaibh beartas, which is like basically an argument between two people, and they'd be scripted like, but I started doing the agaibh beartas first before I did any of the scéalaíocht, which would be the storytelling, and I was good at the agaibh beartas then. So
would that be like a debate, maybe, or
it's more like a kind of a scripted argument,
okay,
between, like, or a debate, you could call it a debate, because it is kind of like one person is trying to prove their point and the other person has to attack their arguments and stuff like that.
Is there a performative or theatrical element?
Well, it's completely,
okay,
yeah, like completely theatrical, and it's supposed to be performed, like you perform a play,
mm-hmm,
or whatever, you know. And I started off doing those, and I did well at them. And one of the teachers then thought that I might be good at the storytelling through Irish, which you're on your own, like, you know. And I did really good at that then. Like, once I started doing that, I won the under 14s All Ireland competition when I was only about 11 or 12. And that was the Oireachtas na hÉireann, which is like a big competition that they have for all these different, they have all these different events. Agaibh Beartas is one of them. They have all different age groups of that, and they have singing, Seanó singing, the old traditional Irish singing, storytelling, lots of more that I couldn't even, you know, go into.
Mm-hmm.
But
it sounds like a concerted effort to keep the culture and language alive and to reward young people for their proficiency.
Well, yeah, it's widely recognized as the, you know, like, if you're going to be good at any of these things, that's how you prove it, you know. I'm the best scaly in Ireland. I won the Oireachtas.
Yeah.
Whatever. But, I won the Oireachtas a few times, twice for storytelling or scéalaíocht, and once for this other thing called Dras Cainte, or it's like the ability to speak. And they give you like a topic, or, you know, it'd be like a debate. But you're supposed to argue one side or another of an argument, and they give you maybe 5 minutes or so many minutes to prepare your little speech that you're going to do, and you have to then deliver your public speech or whatever.
Wow.
And I won that.
So you've got all these awards for competitions that you won in front of a live audience?
Sure.
And now you're bashful over me forcing you to be on the podcast.
Not really. I didn't think I was that bashful.
Well, okay. Reluctant. But once I started asking you questions, it's fine.
Like, I remember one year that I had been doing this storytelling, and We all got called to this kind of a meeting with the teacher, and they were asking us, did we want to be involved with this CD that was being recorded? And I participated in that, like, and one of my classmates did as well. And what they were doing is they were actually telling stories in Irish, or, you know, the story would be written in a book, and you'd also have somebody who was really comfortable speaking in Irish telling the story, that they could play the CD and listen to it, so that you hear the pronunciation and all that, and it's been used for a long time in Ireland. I don't know if they're still using it or not to teach children and stuff, and I'd be on that CD, like.
So if his voice sounds familiar and you went to school in Ireland or were learning Irish, there's a chance there's a reason why.
His CD, I think Rowley is the name of it or something like that. But I told a story called An Peabody, which was about a piper. And I think it was actually a local story, because the Lisbol area is mentioned in the story, and Lisbol is only a couple of miles the other side of Dingle from where I'm from. I'm from like a place called Ballydavid. I'd be close to Fionnuch, you know. I grew up there, and this story in here about the piper, he was a travelling piper, and he didn't have any shoes. Or the shoes that he had, they were worn out, they were no good. And on his travels, one of the days he came across a fine pair of boots that he saw on the road. So he went to investigate, but there was a pair of feet inside in the boots that had been severed. So he said he didn't want to take the feet, he didn't want to take the boots off the feet, because he thought it'd be disrespectful, or, you know, I suppose he was uncomfortable. He was probably superstitious. But he took the legs with him anyway, to make a long story short. And he ended up staying in a barn that night. And he was, you know, this guy was, he travelled from town to town, place to place. So he'd basically knock on doors to control the hay shed I can stay in or whatever. And he got a place to stay off a farmer in a hay shed, and there was a cow inside in the hay shed. And your man, anyway, the piper, when he was all comfortable and relaxed in the hay shed, he said, "You know what? I'll take this pair of boots altogether." And he took the legs out, or took the boots off the legs, I suppose. So he left the legs after him, and away with him was his new pair of boots. And he left early in the morning, like, so when the farmer came back inside in the shed, here was this cow and the two severed legs. So the farmer thought that the cow had eaten the piper, and he thought that he was going to be cursed, and he said he'd have to get rid of the cow, get rid of the evidence, like, you know. So he was going to sell the cow at the quick, the soonest mart that was going to be had, or that sell cattle. He was going to go and sell the cow. And he, away with him anyway, he had a big long journey trying to get the cow into the mart, and everything was going wrong with him, and eventually he managed to sell the cow, and he had to lose money, so he sold the cow at a loss, like. And he said he'd go away and have a drink for himself, and he went into a pub, and there was the piper inside in the pub, and he was dancing up in the, like, whatever dance floor that they have, you know, and that he was, there was sparks coming off his boots, the new boots, taking sparks off the floor. And your man was there he is, you know. So, that was the story that I told. So they recorded me saying that, and there would have been, you know, it would play so much, and you can read along in the book. I think there was so many different stories then to go with it. So yeah, that was a nice thing to be able to do, you know.
So speaking of stories, I want to share how we met. So I was traveling through Ireland with my mom and my sister. Several years ago, I had written my book series called Afterworld, and I wanted to go to the Dingle area specifically because I had been there once when I was a very young woman and got terribly sick on my tour, and I just had fevered memories of it being really pretty, but I couldn't enjoy it because of my illness. So I always thought if I ever went back to Ireland, I definitely want to visit that region again. And then I learned that it was a Gaeltacht and I wanted to learn Irish, or, well, I do want to learn Irish, but I wanted to hear it spoken and have a little bit of cultural immersion. So I was like a low-key version of one of those students showing up in the area. And there are only two pubs in the place where we were staying, and we went into the first one, and I saw one across the way with an Irish name, and I said, do you mind if we go in there real quick before we go to bed? Because I haven't heard any Irish spoken yet, and I would love to hear it, and that place looks like the place to hear it. And sure enough, we walked in, there were some locals playing trad tunes, and people were speaking Irish, and it was clear that this was a little bit more like the locals hub. That was my read. And the other one was maybe catered a bit more to tourists because there was a B&B attached. And I walk in, and it's not quite a fairy tale love at first sight meeting, but I did see that there were a lot of, not no offense, but there were a lot of gray haired folks, and there was a man toward the back who had color in his hair. So I intentionally went to that side of the pub and we set our stuff down. And I went up to order a pint, and my sister wanted to get in touch with her boyfriend, so she wanted me to find out the Wi-Fi password. And I stepped between two gentlemen, who I now know were Ronan and his father. And I ordered my drink and was waiting to, I guess, ask for the password when your dad heard my accent, and he said, what's your name? And I said, I'm Kelly. And he said, no, actually, I think your dad was very direct sometimes. I think he actually said, who are you? Where are you from? And what do you do? And I said, well, my name's Kelly. I'm from California, and I'm a writer. And he's like, well, you write stories? And I said, yeah. And he says, then make sure you talk to this one. And your back was turned to me at the time because you were talking to some other tourists. Mm. He said, make sure you talk to this one. This one loves stories. And I thought, well, okay, an excuse to talk to this guy who has dark hair. And then you turned around and you're like, well, what kind of stories do you write? And I was bashful because at the time, I was very aware of this bias I've spoken of before against fantasy. So I didn't want to just lead with that. So I said, well, they're fiction. And, you know, they usually have an element of like whimsy in them. And you just cut straight to it. And you said, do you write fantasy? And I said, yeah. And you said, that's the best possible answer you ever could have given. Lord of the Rings is my favorite.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, we need to talk.
That's right.
And we just started talking. And at some point, my sister was like, when is she going to give me the Wi-Fi password? I probably already had it. You know, she'd probably already told it to me and I'd forgotten. And so she crept closer to eavesdrop and dropped back to my mom. And my mom's like, how is she talking to this guy so much already? And my sister said something like, I heard the word dwarves. They're already talking about Lord of the Rings stuff. And they like literally just met.
Yeah.
So it was that level of clicking and bonding over fantasy that initially caught each other's attention.
Yeah.
I remember at the time you kept telling me I was the one of the first women that you'd ever met who was into Tolkien.
Yeah, that's right.
So what is your background with Tolkien? When did you first encounter his work? Was it the books or the movies?
Books.
Okay.
So I would have read The Hobbit when I was pretty young, you know. Before I even heard of The Lord of the Rings, never even heard of The Lord of the Rings. And I had read The Hobbit and I thought it was all right, you know, and wasn't going too crazy about it. But then I heard about The Lord of the Rings, and I have to admit I had an awful job reading the books. You know, when I was younger, when I was reading the books, I found them very, very slow.
Mm-hmm.
But I still kind of had a love for the story, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the movies really would have you know, hammered it home for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were just so cool, like, you know, and the age I was at when they came out. Like, I remember going to see the first one and everybody was just blown away by them. Like, you know, everybody were like, these are on a different level. And couldn't wait then for the second one and the third one. And we were all kind of half, you know, we're excited for the third one, but you were half disappointed at the same time because you didn't want the whole thing to end, like, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, definitely Lord of the Rings. Like, I probably watched the three movies, you know, 100 times. So, I'd be up there with that kind of a level of fan, all right, like, you know?
And I remember that when we met in the pub that time, I was literally just a few months after returning home from New Zealand after working on that massive book, Middle Earth, from script to screen, building the world of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. And I remember trying to impress you by bringing up pictures on my phone of, there's this wall at Weta Workshop in New Zealand called the Weapons Wall, and it's got a lot of the hero swords from the main characters. So, like, Theoden's sword, I think Glamdring, Anduril, Legolas's bow. And I remember pulling that up on my phone and being like, I've got to really impress this guy. Look at this. If you like Lord of the Rings, I live Lord of the Rings, okay?
And I would have been suitably impressed.
Yeah, he played it cool, though. He played it cool, and I didn't even know if he liked me or was interested in me until, like, after about an hour, he was like, can I buy you a drink? And I'm like, oh, he is interested, is he?
Yeah.
So, what other fantasy worlds are you drawn to?
I don't know, I suppose I always had a kind of a thing for fantasy, you know? I remember when I was kind of a young enough kid, I was well able to read now, but I don't know what age I would have been, maybe 6, 7, something like that. I remember my dad bringing home a book that he had acquired from, he was a teacher in Dublin, so he picked up this book somewhere, and it was one of Brian Jack's books, you know, the Redwall series. And I remember reading that as a child. I think it was Outcast of Redwall. And that was my first kind of, you know, I was, ever since reading that book, I was into that kind of thing, like, you know. No, I don't know if you'd call that fantasy.
I would, yeah.
But yeah, it's probably, you know, a bit... childish now for my taste, like, you know, but I would have read a lot of the big names in fantasy over the years. What's the name of your man that wrote the, I can't even think of his name now, the guy that wrote the 10 books, The Seeker.
Oh yeah, Legend of the Seeker.
Yeah. I would have read them. I read Robin Hobb, you know. Various different fantasy authors, like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I liked Robin Hobb a lot, you know.
Terry Goodkind, or Goodkind, wrote
Terry
Legend.
Goodkind.
Yeah, wrote Legend of the Seeker.
I read all of those stuff, all 10 of them.
You were also reading George R. R. Martin when we met.
Yeah. I read George Martin before Game of Thrones was a thing.
Before the TV show?
Oh, before the TV show, yeah. Of course. But, I don't know, I read a lot of Terry Pratchett as well, and different things over the years, but I always had a soft spot for fantasy, like, you know.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know, I suppose just the whole fantastic side of it, like, you know. The swords, the dragons, the magic, you know, who doesn't love that, like, you know?
Do you think you were drawn to it because it was so different than your everyday existence in the modern world?
That's a difficult question to answer. I think that, like, being exposed to it on TV and stuff as a child, I just kind of fell in love with that whole thing of I really like the going back in time aspect of it, like, you know, that the technology isn't there. It's like, it's swords and then bows and arrows, and, you know.
That's one of the things that I've touched on before in this podcast is that's, you know, why I called it Forest Folklore and Fantasies, because I do see so many parallels and intersections between, or among rather, the genre of fantasy, which is largely pre-industrial. So, like you said, we don't have these technological feats that we have today in most high fantasy. And that, you know, I've gone so far as to say I see the genre of fantasy as our modern form of myth-making.
Yeah.
Because it's set in a different place, a different time, removed from our world. And I'm putting you on the spot here, but one thing I've come to in this, doing a season of this show, and that several of my guests have come to, is realizing that part of their love of fantasy is being able to check their identity and their reality at the door and go into a completely different space where stories perhaps are being told through symbols or archetypes, and that keeps them universal, but they get to shed their identity and explore. Can you relate to that?
I suppose I can, yeah. You know, like, I don't know, when you're reading a book like that, you want to find out what happens next, like, you know, and if it's the right type of book. Like, I like books that, you know, I read a lot of Stephen Erickson now, and that's kind of what I consider a grand scale of, you know, world building and character, so many characters and stuff like this. And I remember reading the first book and thinking, oh great, I know everybody now. And the second book then, like, it was just completely different characters again, and just that level of diversity, I suppose, you know, to have so much in it, like, you know.
Yeah. But,
yeah, I don't know. Fantasy is great, isn't it?
Do you feel like it has helped you in your daily life? Vicariously going on these adventures and conquering these challenges, and then...
I suppose it has, yeah, you know.
Is really, I feel like that's what most stories come down to. It is to take you out of yourself and to immerse you in a different experience and then return you to yourself so that you can learn vicariously. And for whatever reason, there's a large group of us that prefer to do that through fantasy. It has to be a remarkably well-told film or book. Now, that said, I really don't seek that type of book to tell a story in the here and now that really makes me feel as if I've had that transformational experience where I was in that character's mind and went through their experience. But with fantasy, I'm not as concerned with being in that character's skin as I am with being in the story and gleaning what I can from the story. And maybe that's part of the appeal as well.
That it's not real, like, that you don't, you know, it's not real.
But is it? It's not an immediate reality reflected in my life, but I still see so many of the grand themes reflected in our lives. But again, they're told through archetypes and through symbols. I mean, Gollum in the Ring and Frodo in the Ring, that's a symbol for the seduction of power, ultimate corruption of power. And you could even argue that there's an element of addiction to the ring. The ring brings out the worst in people. And so to me, I can transfer that to And in fact, because I'm in such geeky Lord of the Rings circles, that it will come up in everyday conversation of, oh, that's like the One Ring to that person. Like that's that little bit of power that person is seeking is starting to corrupt them already. So that's where I see that it's crossed into reality as well. The symbols of, I'm just using Lord of the Rings as an example.
Yeah, oh no, but I would have heard that those references, type of references being made as well, you know?
Yeah.
It's mainstream now. Like, I remember when I was in school and stuff, you'd nearly be embarrassed to be talking about, oh yeah, I like Lord of the Rings, or, you know, I was kind of half into Warhammer as a kid, like, and, you know, you would have been kind of singled out, like, oh, he's a, you know, I don't know, you guys call it nerd here, but we had a different word for it. But,
too inappropriate to say.
I can't think of it.
Oh, okay.
It was a silly word. It was like nerds.
Yeah.
Something similar to that, but
a dweeb.
Yeah, not exactly dweeb, but.
Well, that's what's funny about us being on the older.
A swat, maybe. No, swat was somebody who studied too much.
Being on the elder side of the millennial generation, that's your experience definitely echoes mine in that it was not popular culture. Like, being interested in Star Wars, believe it or not, when I was a teenager, was nerd stuff.
Yeah, a geek or something, they'd call you, like, you know.
Now it's hyper-commercialized popular culture. There's even a whole section of Disneyland dedicated to Star Wars, so.
But like, I really do feel that, you know, I remember when, you know, you wouldn't talk about this kind of thing in public, like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great that you can know, like, and I think Lord of the Rings was a massive part of that, like, you know, just because it was such a well-made, you know, like, even the way that they took that story and brought it to the screen and told it in such an exciting way that it made, like, three brilliant movies, you know?
That won dozens of Academy Awards.
Yeah, well, like, that's because it was ahead of its time, and the effects,
yeah.
The effects and everything were, like, you know, just so far ahead of anything that had been done before. And I was like, right, the exact time of my youth that I was into all that kind of, like, you know, how could you get cooler than the orcs and stuff? And
I love hearing that point of view, because I was more into Star Wars at the time and was somewhat dragged to the theater to see the first film, didn't particularly enjoy it. And, like, that's something I have to grapple with as a hardcore Tolkien geek now. And it wasn't until my second viewing on a dark and stormy night that I had to go through this change. I was comfortable, cozy as a senior in high school. Then I had to lose all that to actually understand more of what the story was about.
Yeah.
I had to understand that, like, if you don't see your friends every day, are they really your friends anymore? And to go through that transition more into adulthood to really connect with a lot of the themes.
Yeah, I suppose The Lord of the Rings, you know, it's something that has stood the test of time, really, like, you know.
Yeah.
Like, even as a story, you know, the book has been around for a long time and stuff, like, you know.
Since the 50s, at least.
Yeah.
I think The Hobbit was the 30s.
I don't know. I've witnessed other people reading the book, and they seem to be, you know, happy to read it, but I found it very slow, and, you know, like, you know, I found that the description of minute thing, mm-hmm. nature and stuff, you know, I could have skipped that, like, you know.
Yeah Tolkien has, I feel like Tolkien's an acquired taste in a lot of ways. He's not in a rush to tell his story. It's quite meandering, and, like, it may be sacrilegious to say this, but I feel as if it passed an editor's desk today in a world where writing is so heavily influenced by cinematic storytelling. I think it would have been gutted.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to the books after seeing the films and was actually shocked at how little description there was of the characters and of their clothing and their armor and their weapons, where it was, as you said, so vividly brought to life in the films. And I remember, because I was very enchanted by Legolas at that point in my life, and I remember reading the description of him, and it was like he was tall and wore brown and green or something like that. That was it. I'm like, okay, that's it. Man, they really filled in the gaps with this art department, and all the folks who, you know, brought the film to life really had their work cut out for them. But I also can appreciate the slow moments and the dawdling and the slower pace of describing things. But yes, you do have to be in the right mindset for it.
Yeah, well, I suppose that when I read the books, I was a young teenage boy, like, you know, and it's all I wanted was action, and I wanted it straight away. I didn't, you know, I wasn't into all this.
Where are the battles?
I wanted battles, yeah, yeah.
Renan, it has been an absolute delight to have you as my podcast buddy today. Before I let you go, however, I'm sure many of my listeners are absolutely fascinated by the Irish language, just as I am. My Irish is quite poor, despite your wonderful efforts to teach me. And there's just something about learning even just which muscles to use to form the words when you're young and having that muscle memory versus coming to it as an adult and attempting to pick it up. But could you leave us with perhaps a few phrases or words in Irish that our listeners could maybe use sometime? For example, an expression that maybe in my books that Americans wouldn't be so used to hearing is the Irish word crack, and that's C-R-A-I-C. What does that mean?
Well, crack, I suppose, is just good fun, you know? If the crack is good, it means everybody was having a good time, you know?
So what's an example of like a phrase in English that you would use that word in?
I suppose where I come from, fellas would say, what's the crack, a lot, or how's the crack? And that just means, like, how's it going, or how are you?
Yeah. Could you give us, like, three Irish, commonly used Irish words and their definitions? Like the ones I picked up on first were, like, basically hello / goodbye, thank you, that kind of thing.
Well, I suppose hello. People say hello in Irish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They'd say díolait, which is God be with you or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was a common way that people would greet each other, you know. Being a Catholic country, I suppose it was a common way of greeting each other, díolait, you know.
How do you say thank you?
Thank you is gurav ma agut. Gurav ma agut. And it kind of means there was good of you. Ma is good. And agut means if something is agut, you have it, you know. So
I like that.
Gurev mahagut. Gurev. I think it kind of roughly translates as it was good of you or something like that, you know.
And how about slán and sláinte?
Slán is a way of saying goodbye, but slán it also means like safe, you know. To come safely out of a situation, hánigse slánas, the Mohanadar slánas. So slán when you're saying slán to somebody, you're kind of saying safe home or safe journey or safe.
Mm.
So that's how you'd say goodbye. Then you'd say slán a lot, you know.
And how about for the folks who want to impress their friends by doing it like a cheers, like a toast?
Well, I suppose that's the famous one, is slán to, in Irish, instead of cheers, it means good health, you know. So, slán to Navarre. Agus gamarig na mná, good yo, which means the health of the men and may the women live forever.
Really?
Yeah.
I like that one.
Famous one. As we have.
Well, on that note, Ranan and I are going to bid you, dear listener, a farewell, or rather, a slán.
Slán go fóilín. That means goodbye for a little bit.
Yes, goodbye for a little bit. I've got one more episode planned before I take a little break and wrap up this season of the podcast. And I just want to thank you so much again for joining us. And I hope you have learned something about another part of the world and perhaps another culture, or maybe learned a bit about a culture that is in your bloodline. Perhaps you have some Irish blood, and this has been a good opportunity for you to learn a bit more about what life can be like there. And of course, I want to thank my patrons and encourage anyone listening who enjoyed this episode to share it with a friend and to give this podcast a follow and perhaps even a nice review on whatever platform you happen to be listening to it on. And these episodes, just to reiterate, are always available for free on my Patreon, and you can sign up for free and then upgrade if you so desire. And what I love about Patreon and posting the episodes on YouTube is there is room for both of us to comment and have a bit of a discussion about each episode. So thank you so much again, and thank you to the composer Lane Thomas for the use of his track The Village from his fantasy themed album The Lands Beyond. Until next time, may your hearth be warm and your heart be full.